Turn this on so I can say something funny about that.
Ah, okay, so now I can say something funny about that. Say that again.
Susquehanna.
Yeah, it's actually pronounced Susquehanna. And there's a story. There's a story about that. I'm going to interrupt him now in the middle of his introduction.
Is there a turn on?
Isn't it on?
It's on.
I read somewhere after I moved there that Samuel Taylor Coleridge at one point had grand ambitions to, with some friends, put together some sort of utopian community in the Americas, and the place that he wanted to locate it was the Susquehanna country. First, because he heard it was very beautiful, but secondly, because he really liked the sound of the name.
Alex is running his work in quantum structures, particularly in the virtual test spaces and walking around prisons and things like that. And she's also been recently involved in some of the cross collaboration work that's going on between people who are interested in foundations of quantum theory from a quantum information point of view. And people from the quantum structures community, and I think it's going to talk about some of that today.
Thanks, man. So as I was telling Matt, this talk, for various reasons that I need to go into, was originally intended to be, and was sort of advertised to Matt as something that would be done with slides. Well into preparing what were going to be just the most magnificent slides. Somebody showed me how to use the sort of LaTeX add-on called Beamer that lets you produce sort of PowerPoint-like sequences of PDF files to project. And needless to say, I spent all my time figuring out how to do niftier and niftier things with Beamer, and none of my time thinking about what I actually said. So at the last moment, I find myself here with some sort of an idea of what I'm going to say, but no slides. So I'll use chalk instead, and I'll try to sort of cover up as best I can for the fact that this is almost an impromptu. Okay. So okay. So the title of the talk that I sent Matt was something like probability theory, classical quantum, and otherwise, which is sort of a boilerplate title, probably given a talk by that name half a dozen times. It's never the same talk twice. Just couldn't think of anything better to call it. But that actually covers it pretty well. The theme of the talk, if it has a broad theme, is that when you view quantum mechanics as a probability theory, so probabilistic calculus, which it is, but it also it looks really odd. It looks very special, and special in ways that are kind of hard to motivate, and maybe even hard to characterize. So that presents one problem, a conceptual problem, and maybe a mathematical problem, which in a nutshell is what is so special about mechanics against the broader background of probabilistic theories. So what I'm going to do today is to focus mostly on some things that turn out not to be very special about quantum mechanics. I'll say a few more words by way of introduction, because I'm in the middle of the introduction now. Then I'll show you a general framework that, in one stylistic variant or another, has been around for a long time, probably going back at least to the work of Mackey in those late 50s. Just so that we have some sort of a definite language in which to talk about, a definite precise language in which to talk about what we might mean by a probabilistic model in general. Once I've established that, I'll tell you how to form tensor products of such models, a couple. Somewhere in here, I'll make some passing remarks about some features of all non-classical theories, coupled in the way that I'm going to uncouple them, that are reminiscent of things that are familiar in quantum mechanics, familiarly non-classical things, like the the general phenomenon, I suppose, of entanglement. The first thing to mention. Once I have this set up, I can sketch for you a very generic no-cloning theorem, which was proved a little while ago by Matt Leifer, but he didn't know it at the time. We were having some conversations at another conference, and I said, so tell me how no-cloning works. And I kept asking him questions because I didn't understand. And at the end of the day, he answered my questions in a sufficiently complete way that without really realizing it, he essentially outlined the proof of this theorem. I just had to go home and write it down and send it back to Matt. He said, oh, my goodness. Maybe it's of some interest. And then I'll close with some sober concluding remarks and try to tie things together. Please feel free at any time to interrupt with questions. You can raise your hand. As I like to tell my undergraduate students, they never listen. Just shout out the questions. Okay, so. So we're all familiar with the fact that quantum mechanics is typically construed as a non-classical, in a sense to be spelled out, probability theory, probability calculus. And In the briefest possible sketch, the way this works is as follows. You take classical probabilistic ideas, like probability measure and random variable, and you replace them by, or maybe more accurately, you generalize them to the concepts of, respectively, a state on a C-star algebra and a self-adjoint element on a C-star algebra. Needless to say, the same C-star algebra. And then, of course, the classical case you more or less recover as the particular instance of this scheme in which the C-star algebra is commutative. And then you say, well, in this more general setting, the C-star algebra needn't be commutative. The rough idea is that if random variables now understood qua self-adjoint elements of a C-star algebra, if they don't commute, then they're not measurable together. They're not simultaneously measurable. Maybe I'll just say co-measurable. In some sense that, depending on how you're presenting the matter, you may or may not spell out more fully than that. But there's a problem with this way of presenting quantum mechanics. And the problem is essentially this. If we merely allow the possibility of non-co-measurable random variables or observables, if we simply weaken the usual tenets of classical probability theory by saying, very well, not every pair of random quantities is going to be simultaneously measurable, then we throw open the door to an enormous, a very, very broad landscape of formal possibilities. Possible probability theories, you might say. I'll start writing PTs for probability theories. Okay. So once you allow that there might be non-commensurable random quantities, you have have an enormous range of available probability models, most of them very, very far removed from the C-star algebraic framework of quantum mechanics, from any sort of star algebraic framework. Against this background, the specific quantum models look very, very special. But as I said a minute ago, they're special in ways that are really not all that easy to characterize in strictly probabilistic terms. And it's very easy to characterize them in some sense. They're C-star algebraic, perfectly fine characterization, but not a probabilistic characterization. One would like to know what's so special about the quantum probabilistic models. What, if any? Let's agree to write Q. What's so special about that? The idea here is something like this. You'd like to be able to say that there is something about those particular mathematical models that is canonical, in the sense that it gives you some sort of particularly natural, particularly efficient, particularly nice, maybe ideally some unique solution to some class of statistical probabilistic problems, understanding those attributes very broadly. And it's not so easy to provide that. A little bit of history is maybe in order here. The question, what's so special about quantum probability theory, is a very, very venerable question. It's one that's receiving a lot of attention right now, but it's old. It certainly goes back to the already mentioned work of Mackey in the late 50s. One might mention that Gleason's theorem was actually part of Mackey's program. Gleason wrote his paper in answer to a problem, a technical problem that Mackey put to him. You also have, a little bit later, the work of Ludwig, and many, many others, all of which may be broadly, without doing it too much injustice, one could call the quantum logic approach to answering this question.
Don't tell Ludwig.
I won't. I won't, and that's an important point. I don't think it does him too much injustice. People like Fowles and Randall were also people who called themselves as critics of quantum logic. But at the same time, I think that the machinery that was being deployed, the sorts of technical questions that were being asked in service of answering that larger question, were all sufficiently similar, or a sufficiently tight family resemblance, that I'm comfortable with that. Is it a matter? Yes, it's a matter. Now, for reasons that I think I'll be able to touch on a little bit later, this program, one could probably make a case that what I'm about to say is too strong, but I'll say it anyway. This program, in some sense, disintegrated. Perhaps sometime in the late 80s, early 90s, after obtaining lots and lots and lots of partial results and producing lots and lots of very interesting mathematics, at the end of the day, it just wasn't clear that one was getting a clean answer to that question. And there were certain results by the ladies that were on the table that sort of suggested that one maybe wasn't going to. Now, more recently, a number of people, essentially independently of this tradition, people working in quantum information theory, many of them here, or formerly here, people including Lucian Hardy, people including Dariano, who's not here. I think he's here. Is he here? Everyone seems to be here, so you never know. I guess one would add maybe Ross Speckens, Matt, I think, goes in this group. Barrett. And Alia. They've returned to this basic question, but have brought to the table ideas from quantum information theory, which are from the point of view of this older tradition, novel. Whether this new sort of quantum information theoretic approach to the problem is going to bear better fruit than the older tradition did, I think, remains to be seen, but it's certainly producing different results, and some of them are very encouraging. Okay, so that's amply enough by way of introduction. I'd like to turn now to a quick sketch of a framework, a mathematical framework for describing probability theories generally. And this is a very ancient I put my erasers out of my reach. So this is a fairly standard framework. One that, as I said earlier, goes back to Mackey. A different version of it was developed in great detail by Ludwig. People like Fallis and Randall had their own version of it. My sense is that the formalism that Leach and Hardy produce is in many ways another stylistic variant of the same formalism independently discovered. As you'll see, the framework I'm going to describe to you is not one that is hard to discover if you're looking for such a framework. It recommends itself. It's more or less the framework that anyone would write down. So here goes. A probabilistic theory should, at a minimum, allow one to talk about a set of states. States should assign probabilities to the results of measurements, so one should have things play the role of observables, random variables, and more classical. Well, the states should form a set, of course, and arguably they should form a convex set, because if I have prepared two states, I should be able to randomize. Able to make mixtures. Okay, so let's assume that the states are modeled by a convex set. Let's call it capital Omega. The states serve to adapt probabilities, the results of measurements, so we need some way to describe that. And a mathematically very, natural way to do that is to say that an observable is the following. This will have several parts. Let me let capital A of omega stand for the vector space of all affine linear functions, real linear functions on this convex set. These affine functionals are ordered pointwise on omega. You can say one functional is bigger than another if it takes a larger value state. We can introduce the unit functional, which I'll call little u. It's the functional whose value at every state little omega is 1. We can look at the interval, in the order theoretic sense, of all affine functionals on omega that lie between the identically zero functional and this unit functional. And with that apparatus, here's what an observable is. An observable is a mapping, F. Let's talk about a discrete observable, keep it simple. It's a mapping from some set of outcomes into this interval of affine functionals assigned to each outcome, little x, in this set of possible outcomes, a functional that's called f sub x in here, with the sole restriction that when I add up over all the possible outcomes, these functionals, I get the unit functional. And all that that means is that when I evaluate the functional fx at the state omega, sum up over all the x's, I should get 1. In other words, this is just the apparatus we need in order to pull states in this abstract convex set back to probability weights on this outcome set. That's what it does. In fact, that might be worth noticing. If I have f star, an affine mapping from omega into the set of classical probability weights on E, I'm going to denote that by delta of E. That's, that notation is chosen to remind us that the set of all probability weights on a set is geometrically a simplex. The simplest case of an observable, of course, is the case in which the set E of possible outcomes is actually literally a subset of the order interval. I will sometimes, when speaking about observables, just go directly to this particular simple instance, an observable, you know, this simple type, it's simply a subset of this order interval with the property that it's, that its elements sum to the unit element. Okay, a remark I should make at this point, in case it's bothering anybody, in case the issue is bothering anybody, is the following. I didn't say what sort of a convex set omega was. I didn't say anything about the sense in which these sums converge. One can nail all of that down and make all of that very respectable, but I'm not even going to try today. In fact, I'd like to adopt the standing convention, and just for purposes of expository simplicity, that today all things are finite dimensional. All Hilbert spaces are finite dimensional, all convex sets sit inside some finite dimensional vector space. And that will allow me not to have to worry about these things too much. In fact, not only is everything finite dimensional, but I think also it's quite likely that you regard the outcome sets as observables as being finite sets. Right? So we'll just skate quickly on past all the analytic that would be needed to make things work otherwise, but they can. Okay, so that's a very, very general framework. Extremely general. Includes lots and lots of highly pathological things. What do I mean by a probabilistic model? At this level of generality, essentially, I just mean a convex set. For today's purposes, finite dimensional, more generally, it might be a compact. With this apparatus here serving to provide you with observables. You might worry that that's just too unmanageable, and you'd probably be right. So let me sketch something that's just slightly more concrete and serves as a useful source of examples. Occasionally, maybe more than occasionally, it's helpful to think in these terms. Instead of starting with the states and saying, oh, they form a convex set, well, I might want to start with a model of observables, and say, all right, let's begin with a collection of observables. How should we model that? Well, probably the simplest thing imaginable is to say each observable is simply a set of possible outcomes, a classical discrete sample space. So you have a collection of such sets. Let's call that collection script A. It's simple as script A, consisting of sets E, F, etc. intersection of classical outcome sets or sound spaces. If you begin with such a collection of sets, an arbitrary collection of sets, you can define a state to be a map, let's call it little omega, from the union of all of these sets, assign probabilities to all the outcomes of all of the sets in this collection, that union to the unit interval, and the requirement is only that if this is the real unit. The requirement, the only requirement, is that it sum to one over each set in the collection of sets that you started with. So you've got a collection of sample spaces. You have a simultaneous assignment of probabilities to all the outcomes of all the sample spaces in the collection. That's a state. You gather the states together, you obtain a convex set, call it capital omega. Now you're back in this framework. The sets in the original collection can be associated by evaluation with observables in that sense up there, maybe with some loss of information. Actually, the fact that there's loss of information is potentially important, but not for us today. Okay, so if we can make examples that way, what are some examples? Maybe more interesting than just arbitrary abstract convex set. Well, obviously, classical quantum probability theory fit into this framework, at least discrete finite dimensional quantum probability theory does. So, examples. First example, if script A consists of just a single set, single outcome set, this is classical probability theory, or at least classical discrete probability theory. If script A is the collection of maximal orthonormal subsets, orthonormal bases, Hilbert's favorite dimension, Hilbert space H, or any other Hilbert space H, then this corresponds to discrete quantum probability. Let me throw out one more example just for fun, something that's neither classical nor quantum. Consider any old rectangular array, well, maybe not any old rectangular array. Consider, let's say, a 3x3 rectangular array of points. In fact, you can think of these, this is just a visual model of the set after the set, 3 cross. Consider the collection of 3-element sample spaces comprising the rows and the columns of this array. In that case, the states are essentially just doubly stochastic matrices, 3x3 ones. Take any collection of sets you like. You can define a collection of states of a convex set. You can think of that as a sort of toy probability. Okay, so that's the framework that I want to work in. Now, a natural question, the first time you see a framework this broad and this general, is what can you do working in such a framework without adding any extra assumptions? Well, I'll show you very quickly something that I think is kind of cute. This actually has one assumption that's not trivial buried in it, and that's the standing assumption of finite dimensionality, which I do need. This term, I think, I'm going to embarrass you, but I think the original author of this is in the audience, but I'm not quite sure, and that's Paul Bush. So this may be your theorem. You can say one way or another. I'm not sure if the proof is the same, but you know, tell me if it is. For any finite dimensional convex set omega, there exists what I guess I'm going to call an informationally complete, or IC, interval. concept of information as complete observable, remember, is that of an observable, this is quantum mechanics, that is observable in the general sense of a projection of a positive operator value measure, Q of U, that separates states. The same thing is available in any such theory. So we have finite dimensionality. The proof is really short and goes kind of like this. Start with a basis, let's call it capital B, consisting of vectors little b1, little b2, and so on, up to little bn, remember, by finite functions, for the space of affine linear functionals on omega. Find a positive constant c that is sufficiently large, can always do this, so that for every kxi, bi plus c times the unit functional is non-negative, is in the positive cone. Just take c to be something that's it's larger than the minimum value taken by any of the i's anywhere on this compact, this one you're going to accept. Once you have these, then you note that let's call these guys ki's for short. The sum over I ki's is going to be the sum over bi's, which is it u? We don't know what it is. I haven't said. So I need to add one more thing. Choose this basis and choose this C so that these guys are all positive. I want to claim also, I should have said this initially, that without loss of generality, we can assume that the sum of the BIs is the unit function. Why? The BIs are linearly independent, so they don't sum to zero, they sum to something other than zero. And now just use whatever invertible linear transformation you want to rotate the, so to speak, rotate the basis so that the sum is the unit function. Functional rotated by the Euler or compressed Euler or need to do. With that standard assumption, the sum of the AIs here is the unit functional plus n of these. So it's 1 plus n times c times the unit functional normalized by dividing through by this. AI hat would be AI over 1 plus n c. And that's your informationally complete observable. Informationally complete, why? It's clearly a spanning set. I can recover the AIs and therefore the Bs from these. And it's got n elements, and that's the dimension of the space. So it's a basis, it's a minimal information. Paul, is this essentially something you did in the 80s, right?
Looks familiar. It was at least the spectral optics.
Yeah, I think so.
And it was in the Hilbert space context.
I had the impression that somebody, I thought it was you, around that time, did something like this, sort of in the sort of general kind of convex set framework.
I don't remember.
It was a long time ago. Anyway, it's a nice simple argument. And actually, it's a useful argument, too, this idea of adding multiples of the unit functional to things to make them positive. Or to give them other properties is quite useful. I don't think I'll have time today, but if you're curious, ask me about this. You can use essentially this same trick to show that if you have any collection of overlapping sample spaces, any of these strict A's that I talked about a moment ago, you can always, in a finite dimensional setting, you can always rig up a Hilbert space in which the classical sample spaces comprising your collection show up as not necessarily orthonormal bases, but at least orthonormal sets. So the distinct outcomes of a given experiment always show up as orthonormal vectors. You do that essentially using the same trick. Oh, I'm overselling. I should add that's true if there's a lot of symmetry, if you have a certain amount of symmetry. Okay, so we've talked at some length about the general framework like advertised. And if I'm going to get to the no-cutting theorem, I want to talk quickly about how you form tensor products of models. But I also want to have a brief coffee. kind of tiny break, so I'm going to stop for a moment and invite your questions. Anyone have any questions at all? So I always tell my undergraduates, you know, if you have a question, just come out with it, because someone else will have the same question. I practice in these pilots. Okay. Let's see. Tensor pods. If one's going to do anything like quantum information theory in this general state, you need to have some way to combine models, something like a tensor product. So how do we do that? How do we combine, let's go back to the very abstract setting of models as convex sets, how do we combine two convex sets in a way that would be serviceable as a model of tensor products? It turns out that there's no unique answer to that question. There's actually a whole spectrum of possible tensor products for arbitrary convex sets. However, there are two extreme solutions to the problem. There is, for any two convex sets, a minimal tensor product and a maximum tensor product. One tensor product is the smallest plausible candidate, another that's the biggest. And they're both best described as follows. If we start with two convex sets, let's say omega 1 and omega 2, then let's B of A omega 1 comma A omega 2 stand in the space of bilinear real functionals on these two vector spaces of alpha. Those two spaces, that's A1 and A2, because it's too tedious to write the omegas. Okay? So notice then that if alpha and beta are states in omega 1 and omega 2 respectively, then there's a natural notion of their tensor product. It's a bilinear form or functional in here, given by alpha tensor beta of F tensor G, let's call them from A, little a, little b, where little a is an alpha function of A1, little b of A2, is given by A of alpha times B of beta. In other words, alpha tensor beta works as just a product state in the expected sense. It's to a pair of maybe elements of the unit interval of the first system, the unit interval of the second system, representing two measurement outcomes, two effects. It assigns to them the product of the probabilities, again, those in the two states alpha and beta. Well, clearly, what we have here linearizes. You can now define a sort of tensor product for omega 1 and omega 2 just by looking at convex combinations of pure tensors of that form. So definition, minimal tensor product of omega 1 and omega 2 is the following. Two is the convex hull. I don't need to close it because when I find my dimensions, it's going to be closed anyway. The convex hull of the set of pure tensors of states for the two systems. Now, I'm actually going to show you another tensor product. It's more interest in this. You recognize things in here as the analogs in this general setting of separable states, yes? Weighted averages of product states, they're separable states, at least in quantum mechanics. So borrowing that language, I'm inclined to call this the separable product of the two state spaces. A bigger tensor product, which I'll call the maximal tensor product, is the following. I'm going to reserve the undecorated tensor product symbol for this one, since this is the one I'll be talking about. It's the set of all bilinear functionals on A1 cross A2. Set all A1, A2 that are positive on positive pairs of effects, that is, measurement outcomes, if you like. And it's got to be normal. It's got to add up on the unit functionals for the two systems. So the value of the unit, the two unit functionals to one. That gives you a nice convex set. Anything you want to call a convex set, a convex tensor product for omega 1 and omega 2 would surely be contained in that one. That gives you the freest possible object that, that is, in some sense, a tensor product. Of course, you can consider other tensor products in particular cases that generically will lie between the two. It's not very hard to see that omega set, omega 1 tensor product set, omega 2, that is contained in this larger maximal tensor product. You, in general, have strict conclusion there, and there are lots of possibilities in between, any one of which, I suppose, could count as a tensor product with particular paired models that you're looking at. It's interesting that, again, at least in finite dimensions, things are a little bit more complicated. Otherwise, the only case in which these two tensor products coincide is where at least one of the factors is classic, that is, a simplex. Okay? The only case where they're the same is where one of the factors is classical. In the quantum mechanical case, there's a big gap between the two, and the usual quantum mechanical tensor product sits properly between. These are the separable states. We know that's too small. Turns out this is too big. It contains things that are not representable as density operators on the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces. I won't write down an example now because I'm a little concerned about time, but if you're curious, ask. All right. a little bit of history is in order here, too. These two ways of combining convex sets have been studied in the mathematical literature for a long time. There's a paper by Mamioka and Phelps, something like 68 spells all over this out. But as a device for building models of coupled probabilistic systems, the use of this tensor product here really dates the work of B.J. Fallis and C.H. Randall around 1980, thereabouts. Working together with a postdoc, Matthias Klei, which has left the field since then, Fallis and Randall later proved that it's not necessarily hard to prove if you have the mathematical background, but working with the models they were working with, it wasn't so obvious. They proved that the set of affine functionals on this maximal tensor product of two state spaces is isomorphic as a vector space to the tensor product, the linear tensor product of the two spaces of affine functionals. So this thing works very nicely. Okay, good. So that's a way of combining systems. One more historical remark, and then I'm going to talk about no cloning. I said at the beginning that the quantum logic program ran into some difficulties in the early, late, maybe beginning in the early 80s, by the late 80s. Those were actually ironically connected with the problem of combining quantum logics using a tensor problem. Something that also follows and Randall did collaterally was to show that if you took two orthomodular posets, which were like the most general quantum logic in the model that people were seriously working on, and you tried to find a third orthomodular poset that would represent some kind of tensor product of these, subject to very, very, very weak desiderata. It didn't exist. So the situation there was, yes, we have a nice way of combining models, but those models will tend to be, from the perspective of this traditional ontological program, very pathological. What seems to be happening now is that the maybe with a little irony, the thing that was sort of toxic to the quantological program is the thing that enables the quantum information theoretic program. Once you have a tensor product, you can start to ask standard quantum information theoretic questions. You can ask questions about entanglement measures. You can ask questions about, say, teleportation. And among other things, you can ask, what about the no cloning theorem? We can certainly formulate a notion of cloning. I hope to sketch a proof of what follows, but I think I'm not going to be able to, reasons of time that, yet again, ask me if you're curious. You can certainly formulate the notion of a cloning operation. Let's agree that cloning now for a complex set of anchor, thought of as an abstract state space, is an affine map, convex combination preserving map, kappa, from omega to omega tensor omega, with the property that for every state alpha, maybe not every state, maybe every state in some designated collection, let's say S is some designated collection of states, the map kappa clones that state alpha, produces a pure tensor alpha. Does that seem reasonable? It's a definition of a cloning map. Designate certain states as states to be cloned. And then you ask for a globally defined, find the whole state space, something that could feasibly be considered a dynamics, that would clone those each states. Well, of course, we know that that's not possible in quantum mechanics. If S consists of even two non-orthogonal states. Is there a general story to be told for an abstract convex set? Turns out that there is. Again, at the moment, with a restriction that we're talking about finite dimensions, although I suspect that can probably be removed. We haven't tried to do that yet. But we do have the following theorem to do the math. And John Barrett. Which says the following. If you have a finite collection, an arbitrarily large finite collection of states to be cloned, alpha 1 through alpha n, then those are clonable in the sense of this definition. That implies that there exists a measurement, an observable in the sense that I described, that discriminates amongst them. But there exists an observable in the sense of a subset of this unit interval. That discriminates amongst them in the sense that for each I 1 through n, there exists an outcome of x of I in this observable with that outcome obtaining probability 1 in the alpha of the state. So restricted to this particular observable, these states look like point masses at different points.
Is it really important that they be a finite set?
At the moment, to get the proof to work exactly the way it currently works, it does require it to be a finite set. But that's a point that I think that we can probably.
Right, and you don't have an example of an infinite set.
Not at the moment we have. But I'd be very surprised if there weren't an infinite version of this in infinite dimensions. I think what's going on is sufficiently, somehow sufficiently clean that it should be possible to generalize it pretty far. Of course, the punchline of this is that if all states are simultaneously clonable, if there's a global cloning map that works on all states, or even just all pure states, then you're looking at a simplex because then all finite collections of pure states would be simultaneously discriminable. That's only going to happen in a simplex. Okay, so that's the no cloning theorem. And I won't write down the proof, but I'll say if I understood things in that set to be in Malta, it's sort of folklore. Isn't that really essentially a sort of a folkloric argument written out?
Yeah, I mean, so the folkloric argument is just the obvious idea that if you can claim, then you can create arbitrary many copies, and then
you log large numbers.
Yeah, and then you can
just let you have
those. I mean, in the context of quantum mechanics, obviously, it's very easy to prove.
But the quantum mechanical proof of general.
Right.
But this folkloric argument, which maybe in I don't know, maybe people are used to, I'm speculating here, maybe they're used to seeing it as sort of a reason why you should expect an argument like that to work, or expect a phenomenon like that.
Most people have said, I mean, that argument doesn't seem to depend too much on the structure of quantum theory, right? I didn't say anything about quantum theory when I said it. But it does depend on some notions about you know, what state means in the theory and things like this, like the fact that, you know, if I did have military large number of copies of two different states, then you can have to distinguish them. Which isn't true in any conceivable theory.
But it does work perfectly well here. You know, any sort of an app, any quantum map like this can be iterated. It's actually kind of an interesting thing that if you use this maximal tensor product, there's no analog of the notion of complete positivity. You can take any two positive mappings and find a tensor product for them. And so in particular, you can talk about kappa, tensor kappa, and kappa, tensor kappa, tensor kappa. So you can make arbitrarily large numbers of copies. And you can also take an observable, any observable on which these n states receive different probability weights, any observable that discriminates amongst them in that very weak sense. And for an example, you can take the information we complete observable that we started with, although it's not, that's not really necessary. Take any observable that separates these things probabilistically, however slightly, that will also get, in a natural sense, you can write down that you can make a sort of arbitrary number of copies of that observable. And then on that sort of huge product observable, again, just because of the weak law of large numbers, any state obtained by cloning many, many, many alphas is going to be very concentrated on those strings of outcomes that have an empirical distribution that looks like alpha. And so that allows you to pull back a one capital, pull back that big product observable to an observable on omega, on which that's still true, and now you just take some limits, and you can get those probabilities to converge to one.
So in this general context, is the reverse direction obvious, or
yes? Yes. Yeah, if I can distinguish them, I can write down an affine map that cloned them explicitly. I won't do that right now if you're curious. Okay, so that's sort of the end of the talk. One thing I haven't really gotten to yet is anything that one would call a wild speculation. So I thought it might be fun to finish off with a wildly speculative comment or two. And for that, I think what I'd like to do is to make a kind of a table, at the moment mostly blank. And I'll invite your help in filling it in a little bit. I think you get to be wild along with it. And even before you've had anyone.
Yes.
Okay, so. There are classical probability models. There are quantum probability models, and there are all the others, the non-classical but non-quantum probability models. And then there are various things, qualitative features that such models may have or fail to have. An example may be unique decompositions of mixtures. Well, that defines a simplex. That's true of the classical models, but not of the others. Well, the existence of entanglement. I didn't really say anything about this explicitly, but this maximal tensor product allows states that are not separate, therefore, in some sense, entangled. So, entanglement, in fact, is a generic property of all non-classical models. It's not specific to quantum mechanics. Bell inequalities. Well, same thing. We have Bell inequalities in this general framework. Informationally complete observables. Well, that's true across the board. Every information is complete observable, at least in finite conditions. see standing, standing assumption. All right? Pretty interesting. Pretty sick. No plumbing. Generic. Not true. The classical models, but true for all the others. So here's the wildly speculative part. What are some other beloved non-classical features of quantum mechanics? If you say C-star algebra, I'll hit you. So don't say anything like that. Probabilistically, these things should be expressible. So far you're all disappointing. Shouting things
out. I mean, you already mentioned Bellingham bodies.
Yeah, so I mean, it sort of goes under and down. They don't work quite the same way over here necessarily. You can get bigger than quantum violations. Well, so maybe exactly the quantum violations are a feature that would be specifically quantum, but then that raises questions like why.
So there's this work about communication complexity, showing that if you have like a maximal non-local box, then you have trivial communication complexity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sort of peaks with the quantum.
That's right. I mean, mm-hmm. as you get stronger and stronger theories in mm-hmm. some sense.
Yeah.
The communication cost to
goes down.
Calculate a given function goes down.
Oh, I see.
And quantum mechanics is somewhere in the middle. It's better than classical, but not trivial.
But that's kind of all right. It's a little bit of a slippery slope that one is on. You know, where in the middle is it?
Well, that's right. But I think at least computer scientists have the sense that a theory that has trivial communication complexity is too much.
So we could say something like this. It comes across sounding a little bit vague, but the moderate communication complexity might be there and nowhere else. So that would be a candidate.
Well,
something to look at.
Presumably there are some other theories that also have moderate.
So maybe there are a few over in here.
Yeah.
They work like that. One thing I'm surprised that nobody's asked about is no broadcasting. We don't know. We got the no-plumbing theorem right away, and we've been working kind of hard on this. Howard's been working on no broadcasting for a while, and we it seems like a much harder problem.
So what about cryptography?
Good question. I think John has some results in that direction.
So I think it kind of goes under with these proofs of crypto based on
there's some kind of vaguely implicit assumption there, which is that Alice and Bob have, as far as they're concerned, it's regular quantum mechanics, whereas Eve can access. No, I understand it's not necessary, but it is kind of necessary in the sense that Alice and Bob have to be able to create a Bell inequality violating state in the first place. The only examples I'm thinking of are quantum mechanics and the maximal non-local box, but presumably there are other ones too, and it's not clear that all of these would necessarily have
sort of get quantum mechanics on the nose.
Right. It could be just have somewhere here and somehow it didn't work at all.
So all of these comments actually, I think paint a pretty good picture of where this whole set of questions lies at the moment. There are some things that going to probably be one where it maybe was fairly clear all along, but that would be a pretty generic phenomenon. Others where it's probably not entirely generic, but you're not quite sure how closely it captures quantum mechanics per se. Most of the table, as I said, would be empty. Characterize a big version of the table. I want to add one line. So far, we haven't yet done anything that's really wildly speculative. So I will end with something that's wildly speculative. What about the measurement problem? Don't laugh too hard. One can regard the measurement problem in various formulations as a theorem about quantum mechanics. The various little toy theorems that people prove at the beginnings of philosophy of quantum mechanics books, saying, oh, you look at this horrible problem. No dynamics can reproduce the results of measurements. Those little theorems are little theorems about quantum probabilistic models. They're certainly not theorems about classical probabilistic models. question is there some sort of generic version of the measurement problem? Can you reproduce those arguments in a fairly generic context? If you can reproduce those arguments in a generic context, in other words, if there's this vast array of general probabilistic models, and for essentially all of them you have the measurement problem, doesn't that invite you to ask the following wildly speculative question? What happens to all of the standard, much fought over interpretations of quantum mechanics in these general settings? Can you write down, I'll skip to the most wild of all, can you write down many worlds interpretation for arbitrary models? And if you can, what does that say about the many worlds interpretation? Okay, so I'd say that. So thank you.
I mean, actually, I would, as an intermediate step, is there even dynamics, flexible dynamics?
Yeah, the question is actually a very good question. Before you can entertain the wild question I just threw out there seriously, you have to say something about what the allowed dynamics are. And the problem is that if you start with an abstract convex set, there's an obvious dynamics, which is all the affine self-maps set, or maybe the affine self-maps on a convex sort of truncated cone to allow for non-decreasing effects. But you might have a smaller set that you wanted to work with. And then once you pass to a sort of tensor product, what sort of tensorial dynamics do you allow? A generic measurement problem would probably say something like this. If you're coupling systems, maybe using anything bigger than the minimal separable tensor product, you always have this problem regardless of the dynamics.
If you allow a general affine map, I would think that wasn't.
Well, except that the general affine map would give you measurement outcomes. So that's part of the problem. Part of the reason I ask this is, what's allowed in the orthodox presentation. If you say unitary, well, that just means you've got something that should be maybe reversible at the level of the combined system, but have the right margin. Okay, so you stick some kind of reversibility in as an assumption, and then can you get the measurement problem together? Maybe. I actually played around with this a couple of afternoons ago, and I couldn't quite see how to make it go in complete generality, but maybe it works in some generality, and it's possible that actually this would, if nothing else, help to clarify what's at stake and maybe what isn't at stake in the interpretational debates. So that's as wild as I want to get, especially since we are out here and the wine and cheese is in there. So thank you for staying.